thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the prominent Israeli strategic analyst and security expert, Yossi Alfer, author of Death Tango, Ariel Sharon, Yasser Arafat, and Three Fateful Days in March. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking the last few weeks about the situation of the Jewish community of America in the wake of the coronavirus shutdown and the remote experiences that have prevailed in its wake. You know, at heart, I'm always optimistic about Judaism in the United States. I think that the synagogue as an institution remains vital for the future of Jews as a people and Judaism as a religion in this incredibly important American Jewish community. But there will be changes in how we do Jewish. It's valuable to explore what those changes are likely to be. There are somewhere around 6 million Jews in America today, depending on how you count us and just who thinks they are really Jewish and who doesn't. That makes this the second largest Jewish community in the world today and nearly equal to the population of the Jews of Israel, which passed the U.S. in total Jewish numbers just a few years ago. The American Jewish community remains one of, if not the most successful Jewish community in all of world history, with incredible accomplishments in every field of endeavor and an infrastructure of synagogues, schools, Jewish community centers, and Jewish institutions of every kind spread all across this huge nation. There are Jewish communities of importance in every major and minor city. There are genuinely significant Jewish organizations in every state. Rabbis, cantors, educators, and Jewish administrators are trained in respected institutions of higher Jewish learning, many of them, and good Jewish camps for children and teens exist in every region of the country. There's a strong Jewish presence on every major college campus, often led and supported by two or even three different national Jewish institutions. Support for Israel, one of the central pillars of the American Jewish community's efforts for 75 years, has reached historic heights, at least among the larger non-Jewish American population. In spite of rising anti-Semitism, individual Jews are accepted and important at every level of American society, from politics to business to entertainment and culture, technology, you name it. All should be well. So, why does it feel like we're at an important crossroads and that all this evident success hides a more serious problem underneath it all? And why do the events of the last couple of years point to underlying weaknesses in our national Jewish communities that illustrate a kind of hollowing out and undermining of the entire enterprise maybe afoot? Of course, we Jews, with our long history of tsoras, of persecutions and disasters, always can find the black cloud surrounding every silver lining. Still, there are three areas where the challenges facing the American Jewish community have become evident: aging, assimilation, and the diminishing of the central institution of Judaism, the synagogue. You know, there have been many efforts in recent years to focus attention on the aging of the American Jewish world. Americans in general are getting older on average since we have fewer children and allow fewer immigrants into the country. Those do have more children. And Jews are one of the oldest religious demographics in America in every sense. Part of this is simply the graying of the baby boom generation. The fact that for non-Orthodox Jews, you could actually say for non-ultra-Orthodox Jews, having more than one or perhaps two children is something that doesn't happen much. The math is simple. there are fewer Reform and conservative Jewish kids to replenish the Jewish community. And while there are more Orthodox kids, most of them are ultra-Orthodox. They are certainly Jews and very active within their own sphere, but their involvement in the larger Jewish community is pretty limited. The second issue is the one we've been dealing with for, 40 years or so. It's that many Jews are choosing not to affiliate with the Jewish community in any specific way, or even simply they are walking away from their Jewish identity in every way. Assimilation has been a grave concern for American Jewish leaders for better than a generation. We used to focus on the dangers of intermarriage, but with the Jewish non-Jewish marriage rate for non-Orthodox Jews around 70%, as it has been for a decade, we've also discovered that it is indeed possible to raise committed Jews in intermarried homes. We used to worry that we Jews would be loved to death because of the ease with which we had become part of American society, in the absence of the prevailing anti-Semitism of earlier generations. But it turns out the larger issue is the fact that we haven't done a great job making Judaism integral to the lives of non-Orthodox Jews. There is so much meaning, purpose, and joy in living a committed Jewish life. But both within our families and within our institutions, we haven't really succeeded in making the case that it's at least as important to be actively Jewish as it is to be, say, a big fan of your local sports team or up to date on the latest streaming TV shows. And finally, the gravest danger to the American Jewish community today does not come from rising anti-Semitism. Yes, that's real and dangerous and, of course, distressing, but it's not truly damaging to the Jewish enterprise in any larger sense. The danger comes from the erosion of support and involvement in American Jewish synagogues. There's been a long process of devaluing this central institution of Judaism for the past 2,000 years, insisting in recent decades that we don't need temples to be Jewish, that every idea and Jewish cause supersedes synagogues. There are Jews who insist that Jewish values without Jewish practice or study are the real future for Jews. There are many other Jews who are so closely attached to supporting Israel, they don't actually do anything else Jewish, not Shabbat, not festival observances, not Jewish study or ritual in any meaningful form. And there are some Jews who are so focused on remembering the Holocaust that they don't have time to go to temple or pray or study. There are even some Jews so enamored of Jewish ideals that they believe their principal mission as Jews is to attack Jewish institutions and causes that don't live up to their idea of the highest Jewish ideals and ideas. That is, that it's more important to protest Israel's treatment of Palestinians than it is to belong to a synagogue or support help for the Jewish needy. And, of course, there are a variety of Jewish organizations that insist that they represent the true best way to be Jewish nowadays by giving to a philanthropy or hospital or school, by attending a conference, participating in an online forum or social media interest group or social group. Look, there are many fine ways to express your Judaism, but the only way to do so in genuine community, that is, a community of belief and practice, of prayer, study, communal spirit, and social justice work, the only real way to do that is through a synagogue. I have said it before here on Too Jewish, and I'll say it again. If you took all the many forms of Jewish expression available in this nation, if you had all of them, all the Jewish organizations and interest groups, and no synagogues, in one generation, Judaism would disappear here. And if you, God forbid, took away all those great organizations, all those valuable interest groups and social media platforms and political action groups, and just had synagogues, Judaism would continue in a vital way in future generations. But those synagogues cannot just be virtual. I have recently heard people, even rabbis, express the grave concern that since COVID-19 hit congregants, they have come to realize that they can attend services online while they eat dinner in their sweatpants. And this means, in part, that a lot of them will never come back in person to services. Never. And that, since they can now attend glamorous, over-publicized synagogue services in New York or Los Angeles online, well, they'll just not come back to their local shuls. That may prove to be true for some folks, I'm sure. But I'm just as certain that we human beings need actual live contact with other actual live human beings. That virtual community is not the same as living community, and that the ways that synagogues can continue to flourish is for us to be the warm, welcoming places we like to say that we really are. Yeah, sure, synagogues will need to be better at technology, but that's actually getting easier and less expensive, not harder and more expensive every day. Still, there is no substitute for a good temple. And if we wish Judaism to continue to matter in America, we need to shift resources from the cluttered cornucopia of Jewish organizations and institutions and support the only one that really guarantees the future vitality of Jewish life in America. That is, the synagogues. And I don't mean the ultra-Orthodox ones because they seem somehow to be more authentic. I mean the synagogues that truly reflect contemporary Jewish values of openness, acceptance, commitment to social action, integrity, that are egalitarian and warm and creative, that respect serious contemporary scholarship, that have music that connects modern Jews to our amazing heritage. Anyway, reflecting that last part, you know, the music, and to play us in this morning, here are the Platt brothers singing Hodu L'Adonai, Praise God, something you can do best in a synagogue.
Hodu L'Adonai, Ki Tov, Ki
That was Ben, Jonah, and Henry Platt singing Hodu L'Adonai, Praise God. Our guest this morning is the prominent Israeli strategic analyst, security expert, consultant, and author Yossi Alfer. His new book, Death Tango, Ariel Sharon, Yasser Arafat, and Three Fateful Days in March, reveals significant information about the crucial events that helped shape the relationship between Israel, the Palestinians, even the Lebanese, and shows how the personalities and dynamics of a critical moment in history changed, well, everything. Find out what happened and how it might have been very different when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our special guest this morning. Yossi Alfer is one of the most distinguished journalists and thinkers about the Israeli security situation. He's the author of the new book, Death Tango, Ariel Sharon, Yasser Arafat, Three Fateful Days in March. Born in Washington, Alfair served in the IDF as an intelligence officer in the late 60s, then in the Mossad in the 70s. From 81 to 95, he was associated with the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, eventually becoming director of the center. He also served as director of the American Jewish Committee's Israel Middle East office in Jerusalem and the special advisor to the Prime Minister of Israel. From 2001 to 2012, he was the co-editor of the BitterLemons.net family of internet publications. He has written a series of books about the Israeli, Palestinian, and general Middle East security situations. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us why Death Tango is coming out now. These events are nearly 20 years ago.
The events are exactly 20 years ago. I didn't deliberately time the book for the 20th anniversary of these very fateful events, but it took time for their strategic importance to sink in with me. We're at the end of March 2002. The Pesach bombing at the Park Hotel certainly resonated with many people, but the other the Arab Peace Initiative being approved in Beirut did not resonate in Israel at all at the time. And Operation Defensive Shield, the invasion of the West Bank that followed the Park Hotel bombing, went on for 6 weeks and more, and was part of the Second Intifada, which went on until 2005 or so. Lots of other things were happening then and right after then, the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, for example, the passing of Ariel Sharon. So it took quite a while for all of this to sink in and for me to get some strategic distance, if you like, so I could formulate an approach to dealing with them, so I could grasp the fact that the three events which took place on three consecutive days really were quite formative, particularly with regard to Israeli-Arab peace and Israeli-Palestinian relations ever since.
There's so much more to ask. We will talk much more with Yossi Alfair later here on Too Jewish about Israelis, Palestinians, and those critical 3 days 20 years ago. Just a moment. We'll be back on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A newish, progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night, Saturday morning. Email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Torah study precedes Shabbat morning services at 9 o'clock. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services with full music continue in person, but also by virtual experience. All of our extensive Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those from the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format as well, some students live and some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses in person and on Zoom, all of our services, our Tat Kabbalat Shabbat, our congregational dinners and birthday Shabbat, and so much more. You can find us at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have talked the last couple of weeks about the Jewish community of Norway, which we had never spoken about before in all the years we've done Too Jewish. Let's maybe complete that, and we can do maybe a quick tour of the other Jewish communities in Scandinavia and,
the Nordics.
The Nordic countries.
Right. Okay, so we don't often think about Jews in the northern tip of Europe. We don't know much about the people there either. The fact that some are Scandinavians and others are Nordics comes to most Americans as a surprise. What's even more surprising is that Finland, in the past, when it wasn't ruled by Russia, it was ruled by Sweden. Finland has a very short history as an independent country, although it has a very strong, and these two may be related to each other, cultural and linguistic identity. They were basically enslaved by the Swedes and treated as serfs for centuries. And when the Swedes finally left, they made a grand bargain with the devil that the important Swedish minorities who were left in Finland would be protected, would be able to study their own language in schools, etc., etc. So every Finnish kid has to learn Swedish, and they have a particular animus towards the Swedes because of their history. So they don't do very well at that. They do extremely well learning English. They have one of the best educational systems in the world. But they don't really succeed in teaching Finnish speakers to speak Swedish.
Hmm.
Nor do they do particularly well at teaching Swedish speakers to speak Finnish, because they're resistant to that as well. So generally speaking, in the west of Finland, there are more Swedes, and in the east, there are more Finns. But there are tiny towns where there's a population, let's say, of 100. And when one or two births or deaths will change the balance so that it's 52 Swedish speakers and 48 Finnish speakers, all the street signs have to be changed. The order, Swedish has to go on top if they're a majority, even if it's 52-48. Whereas if it flips, all the street signs have to be redone and Finnish is on top. So it's a peculiar feature of life in the North that many of the countries we think about as having been there forever are actually relatively new as independent countries, even if their languages are not new, and even if their sort of national identity is not new. Now, all these countries have Jewish communities to one extent or another. Denmark's Jewish community is famous because the king and queen of Denmark stepped up famously to save Jews during World War II,
yep.
And they wore the yellow star.
Fantastic story.
They smuggled out as many Jews as they could
almost
to Sweden, which was
a neutral country.
Neutral
throughout the war.
And many of those Danish Jews living in Sweden never saw any reason to return to Denmark. As I said earlier on a previous show, the languages are mutually comprehensible. They're not that different, so there's a very short adjustment period. Probably the biggest and most diverse of these Jewish communities is in Stockholm. And recently, not only Stockholm, but the whole country of Sweden, and particularly a large city to the south called Malmö, which is right across the strait from Copenhagen, they've taken major steps against anti-Semitism, in favor of Holocaust education, et cetera, et cetera. And I am pleased to say that a fellow diplomat and friend of mine, a Jewish guy from California, as a matter of fact, who's now the ambassador of the U.S. in Egypt, played a role in this. He's the one who first brought to the attention of Swedish authorities the need to do Holocaust education in public schools and to add that to the curriculum. So this has been a long time in the works.
It's Malmo's had actually a number of anti-Semitic incidents because of a large Arab and Muslim population that's anti-Israel has attacked Jews over the course of time. And I'm glad to see that they're trying to repair some of that. Tom, thanks very much for a survey of some really interesting Jewish communities. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A group of elderly Jewish men meet weekly for a nosh and a chat. They sit for hours discussing the world's situation, and their discussion is always very negative. One day, Moshe surprises his friends by announcing loudly and clearly, "You know what? I've now become an optimist." Everyone is totally shocked. All conversation among the men dries up. But then Shmuel notices something's not right. He says to Moshe, "Hold on a minute, Moshe. If you're an optimist now, why are you looking so worried?" And Moshe replies, "You think it's so easy being an optimist?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a subtle one, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and try being an optimist. And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah at the heart of Jewish religious experience today, in our portion of Truma this week, God commands the Israelites, "Asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham," make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the Book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and for the building of the Ark of the Covenant are explained in detail. To create the new central shrine for prayer, the place which God's presence will actually inhabit, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. A remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple-building campaign brought in more than was asked for. May it happen again sometime soon, perhaps for Beit Simcha. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a freewill offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous offering is a powerful thing indeed, the truma. For when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, is immediately filled with God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today, in time, love, care, or funds, we seek to recreate that freewill offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our own lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fever. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color. And we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as we pass. May we find the love of God and holiness in our own way in our sanctuaries today. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Yossi Alfer, will continue to explore the decisions that Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat made over three critical days long ago, and how their decisions have continued to shape decades of conflict in Israel. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The history of rare and precious objects with historical and cultural significance was in the Jewish news last week in two quite different ways. First, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston will return a 17th century painting in its collection to the heirs of a Jewish collector from whom the painting was stolen during the Holocaust. The 1646 painting, View of Beverwijk, by Salomon von Reisdale, will be auctioned in April, is expected to sell for between $500,000 and $700,000. Ferenc Horin, a Jewish businessman who lived in Hungary, purchased the paintings before the war. In 1943, Horin placed a number of paintings, including the Reisdale piece, in a bank vault before fleeing the country. Upon returning to the vault after the war, he found its contents, including the painting, had been emptied. He eventually moved to New York in 1947. The Boston Museum's curator of provenance, Victoria Reed, has had concerns about the painting's origins due to a fragment of a label on the back of the painting indicating it had been in Hungary for some amount of time. Just the fact that it came from Hungary raised a red flag, said Reed. Hungary's Jews lost vast amounts of property to the Nazis during World War II, of course. Corrine's daughter, Daisy von Strasser, said that her father, who died in 1964, never searched for the painting but would have been elated to learn that some form of his former life had been found. The painting was discovered by a lawyer hired by the family. But Corrine was less concerned with recovering property than he was relieved that the family made it out of Hungary alive. I do not think he would have made a lot of noise about it. He would have looked at this painting and would have thought that regardless of what they lost in Hungary, they were the luckiest people in the world because they were all alive. Corrine was a wealthy man before the war as head of a steel factory and a member of Hungary's Regent's Privy Council. According to a history of the family compiled by the attorney for Corrine's heirs, he was able to exchange his wealth and control of his factory for his family's freedom and ability to leave Hungary. When he came to New York, he became an investment broker and died in 1964. In other news of valuable historical items of questionable provenance, among the antiquities billionaire philanthropist Michael Steinhardt is accused of trading illegally is a 2,200-year-old artifact likely looted from a cave complex regularly excavated by young Jews traveling to Israel on the Birthright program that Steinhardt helps fund. The ties among the Heliodorus Stella, Birthright Israel, and Michael Steinhardt illuminate just how complicated a relationship Israel has with the philanthropist, widely known there as a generous champion of arts and culture. Prosecutors in New York, well, they felt differently, and they have condemned Steinhardt's rapacious appetite for plundered artifacts, exacting from him last month the promise never again to trade in items produced more than 600 years ago. He also agreed to surrender 180 looted antiquities worth some $70 million, including 40 that came from Israel and the West Bank. But in Israel, where Steinhardt's name appears in the name of a major museum and on the walls of several cultural institutions, responses to the deal have been muted, if they've come at all. Mr. Steinhardt is a valued supporter and a longtime friend of the Israel Museum. His lifelong involvement is genuinely appreciated, the Israel Museum stated. The Heliodorus Stella, on display at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, is among the 180 looted antiquities that Steinhardt has agreed to surrender in a deal with the Manhattan DA's office. The museum, Israel's premier showcase for art, received the Heliodorus Stella from Steinhardt on a long-term loan. It remains there on display. Etched in Greek on a limestone slab, the Stella testifies to the period leading to the Maccabean Revolt, an event memorialized every year during Hanukkah. That Stella was completely unknown to scholars in 2006 when Steinhardt bought it from an antiquities dealer named Gil Chaya. Chaya maintains that the item was purchased legally from a private Palestinian collection formed decades earlier before the laws about looting applied. According to the Manhattan DA's office, Chaya has trafficked in illegal antiquities, and he, too, is under criminal investigation. Well, very complicated, very messy. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both,
Our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our special guest, Yossi Alfer, is a strategic affairs expert, an analyst, consultant, and author on Israel-related strategic issues. He's the author of the prize-winning Periphery, Israel's Search for Middle East Allies, No End of Conflict, Rethinking Israel-Palestine. His most recent book before the current one was Winners and Losers in the Arab Spring, Profiles in Chaos, which won the Chaikin Prize in 2021. And his new book is called Death Tango, Ariel Sharon, Yasser Arafat, Three Fateful Days in March. It's an incredible read. He has an extensive experience in the IDF as an intelligence officer and then worked in the Mossad, headed the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies in Tel Aviv University, advised the Prime Minister of Israel. I want to talk about Death Tango very specifically. I remember visiting the Park Hotel not terribly long after the horrific attack there. It had a tremendous impact, but really it was of a piece with an entire strategy. Can you explain the, for want of a better term, strategy of suicide bombings and how that kind of led to this whole situation?
The Park Hotel was the worst suicide bombing of the Second Intifada. In fact, one could say it's the worst civilian tragedy or civilian losses in Israel's history. 30 dead, and it happened, of course, on the night of Passover Seder.
Pesach.
Celebrating the holiday of Jewish liberation, and this was so it had a particularly strong effect on Israeli public opinion. Now, the Second Intifada, which began in September 2000, was characterized by suicide bombings like this. This was simply the worst, and because it was the worst, it was a kind of last straw, which from a political and international diplomatic standpoint enabled Prime Minister Sharon to launch a full-fledged attack to reoccupy the West Bank and to stand up to international criticism. The United Nations President George W. Bush and so on and so forth. So it constituted a major turning point. Here I have to add that in Arab eyes, and particularly in the eyes of the Hamas Islamist movement, which carried out this attack, it was very much timed to precede the meeting in Beirut of the Arab League to approve the Arab Peace Initiative. Hamas was against the Arab Peace Initiative. Sheikh Yassin, who led Hamas at the time, said very specifically an hour after the Pesach bombing at the Park Hotel, this is designed to torpedo the Arab summit meeting in Beirut. That this did not happen, indeed, that the Arab leaders meeting in Beirut barely paid attention to the Park bombing is quite striking. And it says something about their basic attitude toward the Palestinians and particularly toward Islamist Palestinians like Sheikh Yassin. They simply proceeded to ignore him.
One of the really fascinating observations you make is that the Arab League summit, to some degree, felt like they had to come up with a comprehensive peace plan because of 9/11, that there was this thing, this feeling that they had to respond to it with something positive to change the image of Arabs in the Western world. They used Tom Friedman to do that, kind of. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, it's less, I'd say, an Arab feeling than particularly a Saudi feeling. Let's recall that the perpetrators of 9/11, 15 of the 19 suicide bombers, were Saudi. And the world, the certainly American public opinion and world public opinion to a large extent, suddenly focused on the fact that Saudi Arabia was in many ways an unreformed extremist Islamist state, particularly when it comes to its mosques and its education system. So the Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah, who was the de facto ruler, very much saw the need to make a gesture to facilitate a far more, let's call it, a moderate platform or agenda with regard to particularly to Arab-Israel relations. And this is why he fastened on journalist Tom Friedman's initial proposal of the Arab Peace Initiative, and then a number of different Arab statesmen, some of whom are still alive and some of whom I interviewed for this book, along with Tom Friedman, proceeded to flesh it out and develop it and bring it to the Beirut summit, where Abdullah was very much filled the role of leader of the Arab world. And he was able to present this this initiative, which was for today quite far-reaching. We're talking about a day 20 years before the Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco and Sudan normalized relations with Israel. But he was able to present it as his initiative, even though it didn't really begin with him. I trace it all the way back to the late King Hussein of Jordan several years prior to him. But as his initiative, it helped him smooth relations over with the United States and assume a leadership role in the Arab world.
Ariel Sharon was Prime Minister of Israel in this fateful period. At the time, and Arafat was ensconced as head of the Palestinian Authority. Tell us a little bit about Sharon's thinking and what immediately in the aftermath of the Park Hotel bombing, the Arab Peace Initiative, led him to the invasion and ultimately to Jenin.
Look, I knew Sharon. I spoke with him and interviewed him on a few occasions. Back in the late 90s and the early noughts, when I was dealing with peace process-related issues, Sharon was very strongly against peace initiatives with the Arab world, not only with the Palestinians, but with anyone else in the Arab world, because, and he said it quite frankly, he didn't believe the Arabs. He didn't trust the Arabs to keep their word in any kind of a peace agreement. Now, at the same time, he was not an ideologue. He was very much a pragmatist. So this point of view didn't prevent him, for example, from volunteering in between 77 and 81, when Israel was executing the Camp David peace agreements with the Egyptians. It didn't prevent him from volunteering to dismantle all the Israeli settlements in the Sinai Peninsula in order to facilitate that peace. He understood that when there are peace agreements, you have to deal with them. But he was particularly antagonistic or hostile toward Arafat. He certainly wasn't the only Israeli who was hostile toward Arafat, who saw him as an unreformed terrorist. He refused to negotiate with him, and yet he would send his son, Omri, to bring messages to Arafat, in other words, to have at least indirect contact with him in order to smooth things over when the need arose. Sharon wanted, after the Park bombing of March 27th, he wanted to exile Arafat. He wanted to basically, as he said, let's put him on a helicopter and take him out of Israel and the West Bank and put him in exile where he'll do less damage. And he, this point of view was opposed by the heads of his own security community, head of the Mossad, head of IDF military intelligence, head of the Shin Bet, and they convinced him. So here again, he was prepared to yield, and at the end of a long meeting that went on till 5 in the morning, the Saturday after the Park Hotel bombing, he said, okay, I want to put him on a helicopter, but I'm listening to you, and we won't do it. And instead, we'll invade the West Bank and basically lay siege to Arafat's office residence in the middle of Ramallah.
In the Mukattaa.
If we proceed with this narrative another year or two, we find Sharon radically changed. Sharon, who was in many ways the father of the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, radically changing his point of view, radically evolving, and removing all of the Israeli settlements from the Gaza Strip shortly before he became incapacitated and had to be replaced as prime minister. This is a fascinating personality, and one with this interesting combination of very tough approach toward Arabs in general, yet pragmatism. And perhaps the crowning incident here is that when that Arab summit in Beirut was approaching on March 28th, Sharon sent messages to the Arab world that he wanted an invitation. He wanted to be invited to there. So how do you see this guy who's resolutely against any peace agreements with the Arabs, who doesn't trust them, who actually wants to be invited to their summit meeting? This is because he took the Arab peace initiative seriously, perhaps more seriously than any other leader has, or any other Israeli leader has, then or ever since.
Definitely a fascinating character. I want to thank Yossi Alfer again for a fantastic visit on Two Jewish. And I have to tell you, Death Tango is a great book, beautifully written about terrible subjects, but extremely useful if you want to understand not only the events of 20 years ago, but really the contemporary Middle East. Yossi, thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
YossiAlfer.com.
It's a good place to go.
YossiAlfer, one word, ALPHER.com. You'll find out about the book there, a little bit about me. You can see some video clips, including when I met Sacha Baron Cohen in the movie Bruno, and information about this book as well as earlier books.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Mayor Kate Gallego of Phoenix. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person or on our Facebook page every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat. Incredibly delicious. All starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush. Live in person and available on Facebook. The Torah study is on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from the Amsterdam Klezmer Band. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.